Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear from Jamel Bowie, who covers politics, policy, and race for Slate.com. He'll be heard in conversation with Palma Strand, professor of law in the Creighton University School of Law, in a program entitled Talking About Race, a conversation with Jamel Bowie. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 9, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is David Weber, Associate Professor of Law in the Creighton University School of Law.
He is a staff writer for Slate Magazine, where he writes on politics, policy, and race. He is based in Washington, D.C., and his work has appeared in The American Prospect, The Daily Beast, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, Democracy Journal, and Time. He's a native of Virginia Beach, Virginia, and he attended the University of Virginia, where he graduated with degrees in political and social thought and government. Before we get started, I just wanted to thank four student groups. We have PILF, the Black Law Student Association, the Asian Student Law Association, and the Latino Law Student Association, which were very generous supporters of this event, as well as Dean Marianne Culhane, who has given generously from the law school to make this event possible. So without further ado, I would like to welcome our speaker, and then I will pass over the mic to Professor Strand. What we would like to do during this event is to have a conversation. And so I will be standing around in the back. If you have questions, raise your hand. I will come around with the microphone, and you will be free to ask those questions to Mr. Bowie and or Professor Strand.
So I'm going to start with some questions, and I'm going to go through those questions, and then after we've kind of had that conversation, then we're going to open it up. So we're going to have some of my questions. I get to ask my questions first, in other words. So first of all, thanks to Jamel for coming. Welcome to Omaha again.
Thank you.
And let me just say at the beginning that as part of taking an active part in the 2040 initiative, I've had the opportunity to talk to a lot of people at Creighton and in the broader Omaha community about kind of facilitating a widespread or a broader community conversation about the demographic changes that are coming. And that having this kind of conversation is a healthy and important thing for our whole community. And just the fact that it's healthy and important doesn't mean that it's easy. And so part of what we're doing today is kind of in a way contributing to that, starting it, et cetera. And so I have a number of questions, as I mentioned, but I want to just start with a background question, which is, how did you come to where you are today, writing for Slate? And particularly, how did you come to be writing about policy, politics, and race, which is what your byline says?
So the short story of how I came to writing for Slate is that I went to a party once and met some people. The slightly longer story is that when I was in college, I kept a blog on the 2008 election. After I graduated, I had a few odd jobs around town and kept on doing the blog and hoping to eventually get a job that gave me health insurance. Sometime during that period, I went to a party in D.C. and met a bunch of editors who knew me through the blog and who I knew them through their writing and through their work. And one of them, an editor for The American Prospect, named Ann Friedman, said, hey, you should apply for a writing fellowship. And so I did, and I got hired. And I was hired as just sort of a general purpose politics writer. And over the 3 years I was at The Prospect, that kind of general purpose politics got more and more focused into writing about public policy. And sort of in writing about public policy and like talking to people and educating myself, and kind of getting and deepening my own interest in American history and sort of the history of our policy developments, that kind of led very immediately and clearly to reading more and writing more about race and racism. And so over the course of the 3 years, that kind of became my niche, which continued after I left The Prospect not that long ago and went to The Daily Beast. And then I was at The Daily Beast for a little while and came to Slate earlier this year. And so at Slate, that's a bit, you know, I write about a range of things, but very much the byline is my focus.
Okay. So getting right into the conversation about race part, you are, as people can see in the audience, a member of the millennial generation. You're a young guy, actually. Yeah. And
all my friends are older than the same child.
So you were born, as many of our students were, between the early 80s and the early 2000s. And one of the things that I and others hear is from millennials is that millennials say sometimes, you know, we don't see race. Race is not really an issue. It was an issue in prior generations, but it's not really an issue for us anymore. And first of all, I mean, what do you say to other millennials when you hear this comment? And kind of moving into the next thing that I want to ask you about, how does that strike you, particularly in light of some of the things that have been happening in the news recently, for example, in Ferguson?
Well, so I've thought a lot about why millennials, sort of people, I guess, our age, my age, say that they don't see race. And I think part of it has to do with just kind of the cultural world we live in. You know, if you are 24, if you are 18, you are listening to black artists and Latino artists, you are watching movies and television shows with multiracial casts. I mean, one of the largest film franchises in the world is the Fast and Furious franchise, and that is almost entirely non-white in its cast. And so sort of on this cultural level, it really does seem like these racial distinctions don't matter as much anymore. And along those lines, it's sort of verboten in polite society and to say anything that even resembles a racist remark. And so you see growing up that people are, you know, ostracized from public life for saying racial remarks. You see we have this fairly multicultural pop culture. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually totally reasonable to conclude, and especially since the election of Obama, that, race must not matter that much. But I think part of the problem with that diagnosis is that it ignores the extent to which race and racism specifically is not really entirely a matter of sort of different treatment because of your skin color. And I think this is what gets people a little mixed up sometimes. Racism is it is a structure of power relations. It's a structure of distributing resources, and it manifests itself both in sort of interpersonal relationships, but also in the fact that some people live in very segregated, crime-ridden neighborhoods, and it's not because they are bad people. It's because 50 years ago, those are the neighborhoods their grandparents were shoved into. And the consequences of that action just compound upon themselves decade after decade. Whenever I'm in a situation where someone says, well, race doesn't really matter that much, or you're overblowing the significance of race, I tend to just point to the facts on the ground, really. You know, you look at, there's a great book by a sociologist up in New York named Patrick Sharkey, who wrote a book called Stuck in Place. And what he finds is that if you take the generation of African Americans who lived in what we would call ghettos, but segregated neighborhoods with high levels of poverty, if you took those people in 1970 and you took their children who would be born in the 1980s and 1990s, you'll find that their children live in similarly segregated neighborhoods as their parents did. And more importantly, more shockingly, when you compare them to comparably situated white kids, and comparably situated meaning economically, mm-hmm. they'll live in dramatically poorer neighborhoods than their white counterparts. And so you take a working class black kid, he's going to live in a neighborhood that is much more poor than a working class white kid. So poor, in fact, that it's the kind of neighborhood that white people just generally don't live in. There are very few white Americans that live in a neighborhood that is about 30% poor. That is true for about 30 to 40% of African Americans. And so that, to me, is the significance of race, right? Like, you're born into a certain racial group, and then odds are very good that you're going to end up in a neighborhood that is going to have really negative impacts on your life going down the road, like worse services, more crime, mm-hmm. worse schools, and all these disadvantages that have their basis in racism early on are just going to compound and then pass on to the next generation. That to me is what it means to say that, like, racism is still around, not so much that Yeah, no one calls each other, few people call each other names anymore, mm-hmm. but that's, you know,
whatever. So it's structural.
Yeah, it's structural.
Okay. Turning to Ferguson, which I mentioned, you were, and for those of you who don't know about Ferguson, 2 months ago, the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, police shooting resulted in a fairly violent protest, which led to violence on the part of the police in turn. And you were in Ferguson for...
About two weeks,
yeah. Reporting from Ferguson. And I know, again, talking to people here in Omaha, one of the questions that I've heard is, could Ferguson happen here? Of course, I'm a little unclear what people mean by that. You know, could people get shot here? It's like, yeah. But I think there's also this dynamic of, well, what would happen if, you know, what happens in response to that? And so I would love to hear your thoughts about Ferguson and also just about things about Ferguson that you see in other cities or don't see in other cities.
Right. I was saying this earlier today, what's shocking about Ferguson and the kind of the broader St. Louis County area, since if you're there, I mean, I feel like in the way we talk about Ferguson, it makes it seem as if it's this distinct place, but really it's just like a suburb. It's barely distinguishable from its surrounding areas. So everyone there would just refer to it as North County. And so the thing that's shocking about all of that isn't actually the killing of Michael Brown. This is sort of a terrible thing to say, but a young black guy getting killed by police is really not that unusual. So it happens, and it's terrible, and you feel bad about it. But you know, my reaction at least is not shock. It's sort of like a resignation about the sadness of it all. What was shocking about Ferguson was first the protests, and I should say that they were shocking to residents as well as the rest of us. And they're shocking to residents because the things that led to the protests and that sort of form the context for the killing of Michael Brown have been going on for a long time. You have an area that is among the most segregated in the United States. I think in a 2011 study, they found it was the seventh or eighth most segregated metropolitan area in the country. And you sort of see this as you drive through from the airport to the city. It goes from, you know, immediately when you get into the main freeway going to the airport, you just see like lots of poor neighborhoods, places that are not very developed. And then if you were just to bisect that and maybe take a different exit, you'd see very affluent, mm-hmm. very wealthy areas. Very segregated. The police in the area have a history of brutality and a history of sort of brutality complaints. It was really not hard doing sort of preliminary research to find examples of similar police shootings involving similarly dubious circumstances. And then, this is a bit, it's not very sexy issue, but as a municipal structure, the St. Louis County area is comprised of something like 90 different municipalities, and many of these are very small. I went to one courthouse that was basically just a trailer that they put a sign that's a courthouse on top. I guess that works. And all of these municipalities have municipal services, and the good majority have police forces. And so you have and very low property taxes and no sort of like countywide income tax. And so you have this situation where you have all these municipalities who have to support their police forces and need to find revenue. And the system they figured out for collecting revenue was to stop and fine as many people as possible and, you know, threaten jail time if they don't pay their fees. And so in Ferguson and in Ferguson's neighboring counties, the municipal governments are collecting $2-3 million a year in fines, and these fines comprise something like the third or second largest source of revenue for the municipality. Which is all to say, you have the black population of the area bearing the brunt of this fine collection. That, like, basically, for many residents, the police solely exist to stop them, to give them a citation, to pay a fine, and then this happens over and over again. So you have police brutality, you have police forces that basically exist as revenue collection machines, and you have a highly segregated black populace. And so when the protests happen, I mean, so given that, you'd think that something like these protests would have happened 10 years ago mm-hmm. when, for instance, I would say two African-American men were killed by off-duty cops, and then the prosecutor in the case referred to them as bums that were like that deserved what they were going to get. That, to me, given those circumstances, should have like prompted some sort of protest, and it didn't. And so when Michael Brown was killed, you know, residents and everyone I talked to, they weren't surprised that something like that would happen. What they were surprised is that the entire community kind of just like came up and really challenged it. And I think, just as sort of an observation, I think the difference really was how the event unfolded. You know, Michael Brown was killed. His body was there for 4 hours. Community members came. They looked. They saw. The police officers were unwilling to let the parents come through to see what happened. So there was all this sort of disrespect to the body of Michael Brown that I think really inspired a lot of anger. And you saw some of that anger in the acts of looting that happened the next day when they burned down the convenience store. Well, when a couple, I mean, frankly, when a couple of like teenagers burned down a convenience store and broke some windows. And so that's, I mean, that, you know, that cauldron of stuff and the reaction that it created, and the reaction of the municipal authorities to everything, from obviously trying to cover up the shooting. I don't know if you guys saw the police report that the ACLU was able to get out, and it was basically just sort of like the officer's name and then, you know, a quick scribble, someone got shot, and that was it. And the Ferguson Police Department worked really hard not to let that police report get out. I think around the same time they released the video of the convenience store and suggested that it had something to do with the stop, but like later reporting found that it had nothing to do with the stop. So you have this pattern of behavior from the police force and the city government that was very much trying to obscure and obfuscate what was going on. You had the disrespect. You had the genuinely shocking use of heavily militarized police to deal with protest. Armored cars, tear gas, automatic weapons to deal with what were, you know, for the most part, peaceful protesters. And all of this, for me, being there, was shocking and eye-opening. And I'm not sure I'd go as far to say that Ferguson is the kind of thing that could happen anywhere, because so many of the elements...
It's like a perfect storm.
Yeah, it's like a perfect storm of so many things that went into there. But it's certainly true that elements of that storm exist in many other places in the country.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many cities that are as segregated as St. Louis. There are many, many cities that have police forces that are as... that have such a record of racial bias as the St. Louis County Police Department and sort of in the various municipal police departments. And so, you know, I don't know enough about Omaha to say could Ferguson happen here. Might happen in a place like Washington, D.C., across the river in Anacostia. It certainly could happen in places like Chicago. It could happen in places like Buffalo and Syracuse. Like, just depending on if all the elements are there. And again, those elements exist in a lot of places in the country. And I think what was good about Ferguson was how much it spurred a lot of journalists and a lot of people to begin uncovering the extent to which these conditions exist in a lot of places in the country.
Well, it sounds like what the conditions, really pulling the threads of what those conditions are.
Right.
So,
I mean, I think it was genuinely shocking to a lot of people to see... to see sort of how much disregard for any attempts at like racial fairness there were in Ferguson, and it really just prompted people to ask like, well, where else are people acting like this? Like, I don't think it's a surprise that since the events in Ferguson, it seems like every other day we are seeing a new video of police mistreatment. It seems like Ferguson really prompted people to begin like
paying
more attention and like, you know, just reflexively recording with their phones. And whatever else I had with them.
So I want to pick up on something that you said about St. Louis, which is this question of segregated neighborhoods. And I'm going to get to this in a minute, but Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, appointed to the Supreme Court by President Clinton back in 1993, gave a recent interview to the National Law Journal. And she contrasted the kind of, this is what she said, the pace of public acceptance of black Americans with that of gays and lesbians, focusing on differences in familiarity. And with respect to gays and lesbians, just kind of a note, it's relevant, I think, that just this week, the Supreme Court let stand a number of Court of Appeals rulings holding that prohibitions on same-sex marriage are in violation of the Constitution. So in comparing the relative speed with which social norms have changed with respect to gay and lesbian relationships compared to what she perceives as a slower pace of change with respect to race, this is what she said. She said, once gay people began to say who they were, you found that it was your next-door neighbor or it could be your child, and we found people we admired. That understanding still doesn't exist with race. You still have separation of neighborhoods where the races are not mixed. It's the familiarity with people who are gay that still doesn't exist for race and will remain that way for a long time as long as where we live remains divided. So does that observation strike you as valid? You know, if so, where does it lead us? And if not, you know, where do you think she's kind of heading astray here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the observation about the separation of blacks and whites in particular, but sort of like really whites and everyone else generally, is very true. I forget who did the study, but there is a recent study that found that something like 70% of white Americans did not have. Maybe it was like, I'm almost certainly getting this number wrong, so please fact check me. But the general gist of it is true. And that is that most white Americans could not name a non-white friend. And that's a very small number of white Americans could name anything like more than one non-white friend. The numbers were worse for white Americans naming a black friend and best for other groups. That alone tells you actually a whole lot about how people live, right? It suggests that most people are working in environments that are mostly monochromatic or at least have some sort of social separation. They're certainly living in neighborhoods where they do not have very many in the way of non-white neighbors. They're going to churches that are mostly non-white. I mean, I forget who said it, but the old thing that the most segregated hour in American life is like Sunday at 11 is still very much the case. And so that strikes me as very true, and it also strikes me as having like really important implications for how people think about race and racism. I mean, I just read a story today in the Washington Post about Ferguson and about sort of the divide between white residents and black residents. I mean, here is a place that, you know, 67% black, but it was very clear that many of the white residents simply had no idea that their neighbors felt this way. And it's very clear that, you know, people just didn't talk about it. And so when people do begin talking about it and someone says, well, I really feel afraid of the police, their white neighbor says, well, I don't feel afraid of the police. Like, what's the problem? And that sort of lack of social contact kind of allows people to sort of just not think about how someone else's experience might be different going around in the world. The question of social acceptance, and that's sort of like, I guess, where I differ a little bit with Justice Ginsburg, is interesting because on every sort of measure of like racial tolerance, I guess, Americans are, you know, pretty much in agreement. Like, most Americans agree that interracial dating and interracial marriage is fine, like 87%. Though interestingly, the number of the pace of change for that versus same-sex marriage was much slower. So like the rate at which same-sex marriage reached its sort of like 50% threshold was much faster than the rate at which interracial marriage did. Most Americans agree that discrimination is wrong, that like people should be able to live where they want, so on and so forth. But most people's behavior doesn't always fit with their professed beliefs.
What they say.
And so when you ask, you know, when you ask, this is another recent survey, when you ask white Americans, or when you ask black Americans, what does a diverse neighborhood look like to you? And they'll say, oh, it's like 50% white, 50% black, maybe there's some Latinos and Asian Americans, like everyone there. You ask white Americans the same, their answer tends to be, it's about like 10% minority and then like 90% white. Which tells, I mean, again, tells you a lot about people's perceptions and sort of understanding of how other people are and how they may interact with you in your neighborhood. So it's like it's one of those things where I don't know. I think there is more acceptance of Black Americans and other minorities than Justice Ginsburg maybe gives credit for. But there's, I think, much less than we actually think there is. And I think it just varies on the context. Politically, what we thought of, what people feared about Obama in 2008, or feared with regards to his candidacy, that you'd have a large number of white voters who would profess support for him in polls, but not actually vote for him in the ballot box, turned out not to be the case. And generally, when black candidates are on the ballot for mostly white electorates, they do fine. The problem really there is more of a pipeline problem than it is like people won't vote for a black candidate. That's fine. But when it comes to, say, perceptions of criminality, when it comes to perceptions of poverty, white Americans are still much more likely to say something like, well, blacks and Latinos are responsible for most crime. And so there's still this like perception, there's still these very negative perceptions attached to minorities that I think would be lessened if people lived in closer proximity, if like we actually had an integrated social space that, you know, we really don't at all. Like, there are very few places in the United States where there's any sort of meaningful integration. And even in cities where it is more likely than not to, where blacks and whites and Latinos and Asian Americans are more likely to live sort of near each other, processes of gentrification and like renewal are sort of like quickly, you know, reducing that. So I live in D.C. D.C.'s gone from like 60-70% black 15 years ago to just barely half black to, they project, 40% black in 10 years. And so that's, and you can, if you were to get a map of D.C. and then just color-code it according to race, you'd find like concentrations of blacks in certain areas and concentrations of whites in others with very little.
Which is true of most cities.
Yeah, true of most cities.
Kind of going back to Ferguson a little bit, in the wake of the events in Ferguson, former First Lady Senator and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke to a predominantly white audience in Silicon Valley about the importance of understanding the black or African-American experience. And kind of a very different personality, Jon Stewart included a segment on The Daily Show making really kind of the same point. It's important to really understand what that experience is. In terms of talking about race, you've, I think, made the observation, or at least kind of chimed in on this, that President Obama has actually, in a way, been hampered in having that conversation, and actually made the observation that you think a white president might be more successful. And I'd really be interested in kind of you elaborating on that.
So if you look, I mean, and I forget the researcher who did this work, but he essentially compared references to race in President Obama's speeches to previous presidents, previous Democratic and Republican presidents. And, you know, compared to Republican presidents, he spoke a bit more about race. But compared to Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter and Lyndon Johnson, he spoke much less about race. And he figures this has something to do with just, and this is something that Ta-Nehisi Coates, who writes for The Atlantic, and I'm sure everyone here knows who Ta-Nehisi Coates is, noted in a piece a couple years ago, that it seems that Obama can be a president who is black, but he can't necessarily be a black president who is very much speaking to the concerns of black Americans as well as all Americans. And so I think the administration, I think he personally kind of pulls back on talking about race. And I, you know, the evidence we have suggests that that's not, I mean, there's a good reason for doing so. It's, If you look at the public opinion polls in Obama's first year, he starts off at like 65% approval when he enters office, and there's like kind of the natural degrading of public approval throughout the year. But it kind of stabilizes at just over 50% around April or May. And the first time it drops below 50% and stays below 50% is after the Henry Louis Gates controversy, where he, you know, Skip Gates, Harvard professor, got arrested going to his own home, and President Obama, you know, had a press conference and said this was a silly thing that happened. And his approval rating stays stable among Latinos and African Americans and Asian Americans, and just takes like a dip, like it's a dramatic dip among white Americans. A similar thing happens after he speaks on Trayvon Martin on both occasions, both after the shooting and after the verdict in the Zimmerman case. He has a dip in approval among whites. His favorability among whites sort of goes down or becomes more negative. And those are sort of our available data points. But I think they do really suggest that at the times when President Obama has reminded has reminded the country that he is a black guy, it hasn't worked out for him politically.
Oops.
By the way, guys, this is the thing. So I think that is.
So
true.
That's the part. That's the it's why it's hard for President
Obama. Right. That's
Obama
why it's hard
part.
For President Obama.
Yeah.
Whether or not like a white president could do better is like interesting because, you know, I happen to think that one of the best, most frank speeches on racism ever given by a president was by, or this case, at this point, vice president, was Lyndon Johnson when he gave his 63 Howard commencement, where he sort of like forthrightly spoke about the impact and the role of racism in keeping blacks behind, and very much said that it won't be enough to just like have formal equality. We'll actually have to do things proactively to fix the problem. And I think Lyndon Johnson, both for his own personal reasons, was like very invested in this, but I also think, you know, he kind of had space to say these sort of mm-hmm. things without any kind of backlash. And I wrote that about Hillary Clinton just because of the language she used in talking about Ferguson. She didn't say, you know, you should think more about black people. She said, imagine if it were you, and imagine if it were your neighborhood where your kids were getting shot by police. How would you react? And that is a very different approach, and I think it's it could potentially create a level of empathy between her and an audience that could be very effective. And so if she ends up being president in 3 years, it'll be interesting to see if she does speak more about race, because I think if she's going to take that approach of directly saying to white audiences, you know, imagine if your grandparents weren't allowed to buy homes after fighting in the Second World War. Like, imagine how that would impact you. That could actually change minds and force people to sort of, like, reflect on themselves. But, you know, we'll see.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you a wonky question.
Okay.
A wonky legal question. How's that?
Okay.
Okay. So you've actually also written about the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid. And the background for this is a 2012 Supreme Court decision that upheld the Affordable Care Act as constitutional, but at the same time struck down as impinging on states' rights the mandatory expansion of Medicaid, which is the federal program that provides health care to Americans who live in poverty. And in the wake of this decision, actually about half, almost half, of the states have declined to extend Medicaid into those states. Most of the discussion of Medicaid expansion has focused on Republican resistance to the Affordable Care Act and President Obama. But can you speak to potential racial implications of this state-by-state debate?
Yeah. I mean, the racial implications, the outcomes, are pretty clear. It's something like two-thirds of those affected by not having Medicaid expanded have been low-income black Americans, and particularly low-income black American women, and sort of near elderly, are the ones who... In sort of the deep South states and pretty much the entire South. And then a few other states have been most affected, and the rest are sort of like a large number of other people. So that's sort of, it's clear how that shook out. And anyone looking at it, if you had said to them what would happen if Medicaid weren't fully expanded, would have told you as much. What's interesting about the refusal to expand Medicaid is that it's sort of one of these instances where you can see how race and political ideology have kind of like mixed and created something that's not quite completely racial, but something you just can't chalk up to kind of generic conservatism. So, the 24 states that haven't expanded Medicaid include pretty much the entire South other than Arkansas and Kentucky. And those are two very important exceptions that I think we'll return to in a moment. But all of the states in the South that have not expanded Medicaid are states that were part of the former Confederacy, are states that, at least in Louisiana and South Carolina and Georgia and Florida and Mississippi, had like unusually strong manifestations of Jim Crow, are states that are extremely racially polarized in their politics. If you look at exit polls from 08 or 2012 in Alabama, for instance, it's something like 92% of whites voted for Mitt Romney, 92% of blacks voted for Barack Obama. And in those states, if you are a Republican, it means you are white. And if you are a Democrat, it means you are black. And there's really there's very little crossover. And so in those states as well, their politics developed in this world of racial polarization, in this world of Jim Crow. So you go back to the 1890s and the 1900s in Alabama, and you have floor discussions in the Alabama State House about not expanding public education for everyone because they don't want to spend the money on blacks, and they had been constitutionally obligated to at least spend some money on blacks. In my home state of Virginia, massive resistance in the 50s, like defund lots of public schools as white parents pull their students out of integrated schools, as white politicians try to deny funding to public schools in order to get around it. And you have in these deep South states this what was initially a contingent thing. We're going to not do public investment. We're going to, keep unions out as much as possible because we have this, going back to slavery, this history of very cheap labor, and we do not want any biracial coalition mm-hmm. making happening on the lower income scale. These contingent decisions become sort of like, they become ideological over time. They cease to be, we're doing this because blacks. They become, we're doing this because this is just how we do things.
We just don't do that we kind just, of public investment.
Right, right. And I think right now, a century removed from, or 50 years removed from a lot of this, we're at this point where political conservatism in a place like Mississippi, I don't think is racist, but it reflects its origins in like racist societies. Or racist sort of political backgrounds, and so you can have, which is to say, and this is actually at this point very little about motivations. You can say, I don't want to expand Medicaid because I don't think we should have big government, and the effect of that will be that a lot of poor black people will not be able to get medical care, which is indistinguishable from if the rationale was, I don't want to expand Medicaid because I don't like black people. Like either way, either thing gets you to the same result. And I think that fact that political belief leads you to a place where you essentially starved your low income population, which is mostly black, of public investment, is impossible to untangle from the past history of racism. And there's sort of it's tricky because you're not accusing people of racism. You're not saying you're doing this because you have a holding racial animus. I tend to very much take people at their word when they give their explanation for something. So, a Mississippi lawmaker saying, I just don't think our state could support a Medicaid expansion. I'll take your word for it. You miss it better than I do. But it would be unusual to treat Mississippi's history as just some like odd coincidence when that particular policy choice has this like very racialized effect.
Right.
And I think if you look at sort of the development of political conservatism over the 20th century, that the core battles fought between moderate northern and western Republicans and more conservative southern Republicans in the 1950s and 60s were over the role of the state and were very racialized. And I think that's just carried over time and now just become conservative ideology, but it wasn't always just conservative ideology. It has these roots and these...
In race.
Yeah.
Maybe now would be a good time to start taking questions from the floor. Yeah.
I have a question related to the writing on a blog versus some of the traditional media. My question specifically is, what is your perception of the traditional media? And I know there's been a lot of discussion about the lack of people of color in like our traditional publications. Are the blogs becoming the way that you're putting more of the information out there dealing with race and maybe some of the more controversial issues or whatever? And I'm thinking about the Huffington Post and you name it. So what is your reaction to some of those, what's going on today in our society?
So just to be clear, the question is the question how sort of blogs and new media have like affected, I think so. It's a, as many things with new media, it's been kind of a double-edged sword. The good thing is that there'll be extremely low barrier to entry for writing on the internet, which is essentially like, you know, can you open up Tumblr or can you open up Blogger and start an account? Has been great for bringing, for both like bringing voices and people who can write well on these issues to the fore, and not just sort of like random people, but academics, professionals, people who maybe are thinking about these things in their everyday lives and now have a chance to write about them. And if they are lucky and if they are good, can often actually get into traditional professional media through that. But the other side of it is that, the emergence of new media and the emergence and the decline of traditional media has closed off a lot of avenues for sort of more traditional reporters to get the kind of jobs that give them a lot of visibility. And the pool and the pathway for going from being someone studying journalism in college to being a reporter at the Washington Post, the New York Times, or anywhere is it's harder to find that path, and it's especially harder for minorities who in the past could have written for their city daily or their local daily that may have been focused on community issues, and then from their local daily they can go to the regional daily, from the regional daily they can go to a national paper or a national magazine, and that just doesn't really exist anymore. It's very, very much more haphazard. The potential upside to new media right now is that there are a couple publications who are actually making money and thus hiring, and several of them are making an active effort to have more diverse staffs. And so BuzzFeed, Land of the Cat Listicle, has been on a hiring spree for the last year or so. It raised $50 million, and it's plugging a lot of that money into hiring people. And it's made an explicit effort to hire people of color, and LGBT people and women, and sort of trying to expand its roster of voices. So hopefully, going forward, journalism, I think, is still in its unpleasantness with regards to just jobs. But hopefully going forward, as people figure out how to make money off of the internet, that will change. And sort of the lessons we've learned from expanding access and then getting new voices from this current period will be applied to actually hiring people.
I'm not really sure if you got to answer what was unique about Arkansas and Kentucky.
Oh, I didn't. That's a good point. What's unique about Arkansas and Kentucky is that they are southern states that have very small black populations. And they're southern states that expanded the Affordable Care Act. And I refuse to believe that that's like an odd coincidence, that the two southern states that have very small black populations are also the two, in Kentucky's case, a southern state that was a border state during the Civil War, are also states that expanded Medicaid and built exchanges, built state exchanges for the kind of main part of the law.
Well, listening to what you've said so far, it's all well-informed but passionate and well-balanced. And I wonder, being a journalist in D.C. where so much information in the media is so polarized, how you ensure that the information that you're getting is well-balanced and not polarized, and the reports that you're making give a good picture of what the issues are.
Well, I spend a lot of my time talking to academics. I'm not much of a... Going to Ferguson was like a rare instance of me like going to where the action was. Typically, I will, go over to Georgetown or George Washington or whatever and like just talk to someone who actually does the work that I'm interested in writing about. And that's a good way to keep yourself from getting too deep in the ideological weeds. Right, like if you're just talking to actual experts who like are collecting actual knowledge and not just making conjecture or opinions based off what they think, and who are for professional reasons and then likely personal reasons doing the best they can to get the best information they can, talking to those people and getting their perspectives is a good way to kind of just stay focused. And I think, I'm not going to pretend like I don't have a point of view and an aim here. But I don't think having a point of view and an aim are mutually exclusive with being responsible and being fair and being thorough. And so in D.C., there are a lot of ideological outfits in D.C. But even among ideological outfits, there are real distinctions between people who are doing the best they can as reporters and people who are just trying to like push out a message. And I'd like to think that I'm trying to do the best I can as a reporter who happens to have a perspective that informs his work. But if a piece of information comes my way that challenges something I think, I'm going to take that piece of information seriously and not just dismiss it as as in conflict with my ideological priors. Like that just wouldn't be responsible.
I was just wondering what your perspective is of the rural Midwest in terms of immigration reform, what our state and also in D.C., what are your thoughts about that? And how it pertains to race, obviously, and racism.
I've spent extremely little time in the rural Midwest. I tend to write about what I know, and I'm from the South, and sort of what I know is the South. So I'm not sure I can give like a particularly informed perspective about immigration in the rural Midwest. But I can say that I think some of the dynamics that we're seeing with immigration in the rural South probably apply, which is that the rapid pace of immigration, and in Georgia, which is where a lot of my family's from, the Latino population and Asian American populations have doubled over the last 10 years. The pace of change, like it freaks people out. You're not accustomed to driving down your street and seeing a bunch of Vietnamese restaurants where there were Bojangles. And that in turn is sort of just like influencing the politics of the area. And so Georgia, for instance, had its SB 1070 law, similar law to the one in Arizona a couple years back. It passed a stronger version of its voter ID law in 2011. There really is a sense among certain Georgians that they have to have a response to sort of like stem the change, and there is a really fierce political battle happening there right now between this emergent coalition of African Americans, Latinos, and Asian Americans, and kind of the traditional power base. And I think something like that is happening in every place where there is this rapid growth in immigration. First, there's sort of like the initial, this is the thing that's happening. And then there's everyone trying to figure out what to do about it, whether to mobilize, whether to find ways to kind of stem the tide. And unfortunately, you know, as a country, we have been unable to come to agreement or solution about what we can do to put some boundaries around the process, which has kind of created this odd free-for-all in a lot of different states as different states follow different procedures.
I feel like a lot in discussing race, I'm told by minority friends or friends of other races that growing up a white person in a community where I was of the majority, that I can't really understand where they're coming from. I can't understand the racial issues that they've had to deal with. And so because of that, I feel like a lot of times whites don't want to discuss race because we're afraid of how we'll look, or that we'll come across wrong, or that we'll look like we're encouraging those bad opinions or whatever. And so I feel like that really harms the discussion of race or making things better because we're not opening communication, we're kind of closing ourselves off. Do you see a way for that, for us to be better about that, yeah, for people of any race to open up the discussion more?
So, you know, not too long ago, I probably would have been on the side of the just stop talking, just stop it, folks. Now I'm sort of at this point where we have so few conversations about racism, and those conversations are so fraught that I kind of just think people should have them regardless of the potential for something going awry, just to be comfortable doing it and let things go awry. It's not going to be the worst thing in the world if you say something a little bit racist. You'll get corrected and you'll move on. It's not going to ruin your life. And I think, I mean, for me, you know, for me, an analogy is just like talking about sexism, right? Like I have gone through the world thus far as a man. My experience is, hey, not trying to be heteronormative. My experiences of the world are as a man, and there are things a lot of things about the way women experience the world that I just am not going to get. So rather than, my strategy for this is first just to listen, just to like, you know, if I have a question, just ask a close friend, and not worry too much about if I mess up the wording. If I mess up the wording, she will tell me, and I will be corrected, and I will actually learn something in the process. And so I think, you know, I really think people should not worry so much about saying the wrong thing, because at a certain point, when you worry so much about saying the wrong thing, you're just never going to say anything. And I think we're at a place right now where no one wants to say anything, and if saying something just means you're going to have a pie on your face a couple times, and let that be the case. And I think on all sides, people just need to understand that what's important is that we start talking about this, because without talking about it, you can't really come to any solutions. And not only can you not come to any solutions, but you end up in a place, you know, like where Ferguson is, frankly, where when something happens, no one has the language to process it. Like, the white residents of Ferguson don't have the language to process what's happened, and so instead of trying to find that language, they feel defensive. And in feeling defensive, they become unwilling to maybe even begin the process of listening again.
Let's take one more question.
Yeah, I think we have time for one more.
You kind of talked about before the idea of President Obama and his effectiveness compared to maybe Hillary Clinton or a white president in terms of talking about these issues. Similarly, have you found, how has that kind of affected you as a reporter, maybe looking at white men or women who are trying to talk about and open up discussion for the same thing? Has that played a part? And maybe not even journalists, but other people who are trying to open that discussion.
It's funny because I literally just had a conversation with a bunch of my black reporter friends about this very recently, because we were all in Ferguson and we all thought to ourselves, man, it would be really great if we could get if we could just like talk to white Ferguson residents and see what they think. But it's sort of like how in how in Star Trek, they have the prime directive because you can't once Starfleet interacts with the planet that is not sufficiently advanced, it's just like thrown that planet's course of development off the rails. As much as I would really love to, I would have loved to talk to a bunch of white Ferguson residents candidly, I'm not sure that would have been possible just because of sort of like different expectations and sort of like fears and worry about all that. So I think for me as like a reporter who wants to know more about how different people talk about race, it is kind of a barrier. There are limits to where I can go and what I can get people to say that don't exist for a white reporter, which is why I want more white reporters to cover this stuff. I don't want racism to be something that just minority reporters cover, because race is something that doesn't just affect minorities, it affects all of us. And so, I very much want, both for like selfish reasons that I want to read that story and because I think it's actually vital and necessary for white reporters to see that their role is also reporting on race, even if it means the occasional stumble and the occasional mistake. Again, people make mistakes, who cares?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard from Jamel Bowie, who covers politics, policy, and race for Slate.com. He has been heard in conversation with Palma Strand, professor of law in the Creighton University School of Law, in a program entitled Talking About Race, A Conversation with Jamel Bowie. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 9th, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and Lauren Ulrich, Marketing Strategist for the Creighton University School of Law, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.